What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. I am Jamie Dodd, my co-host, Canucks insider Thomas Drance, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drance, what's going on, man? Welcome back to the show after an absence yesterday.
Hey, buddy. Yeah, no, doing well. I'm down in California, so we're going to be doing the show remotely for a few weeks here, which, let's be honest, it impacts our flow a little bit, but we always make it work. Yeah, that's the good thing about chemistry like we've got, buddy. Very much like Quinn Hughes and Philip Peronic, right?
I don't want to start divvying up who's who in that relationship. Let's pump the brakes there.
Given that I'm crankier, and that you sleep more than I do, I think we know.
I do get a lot of sleep. So do you want to start there?
Quinn Hughes both.
Do we want to start with Philip Peronic? I mean, since you're bringing him up, right?
Honestly,
that dynamic between Hronik and Hughes, which hangs over the entire question going into the offseason. But, you know, I know you had the kind of to-do list, priority list up at The Athletic today for the Canucks offseason. And, of course, and we can get the debate about what the best solution looks like for the Philip Hronik situation. But, of course, I think no matter where you land on him as a player, his status, his situation, obviously at the top of the list to figure out, okay, what are we doing here? What is the resolution going to be?
Yeah, so I'm working through a bunch of things this week. And to some extent, if you go into The Athletic, you'll see, you know, I do the every year I stack the Canucks up against the conference finalists. That was Monday. Today, the offseason to-do list. And then tomorrow or Thursday, depending on how much time I spend working as opposed to being in the sun this afternoon, I'll do the full-on cap projection and what the big takeaway is. And for me, it's like, I think it's good content, but for me, it's more a process that I need to go through. Mm. It's more working through my own process, but I'm sort of slowly coming to a take that I want to come out hot. I want to drop this slowly developing take, and then I want to reserve the right to amend it as we go slightly. But the more I pick this up, pull it apart, examine it, and think about the challenge of especially the next month, right? Leading into the draft, leading into free agency. The more I think about it, the more convinced I am that while this market is going to spend weeks, I think, in a tizzy. We saw some of it with Rick Dhaliwal's Nikita Zadorov. Like, 6 million times 7 years? Is that something? Mm-hmm. I don't think the Canucks can do that. You know, there was an offer. Maybe it was 4.5 million over five. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing? This is a team that's returning Brock Besser, Elias Pettersson, you know, JT Miller, Thatcher Demko, Quinn Hughes, right? Like, the core of this team is effectively intact. And there's actually some pretty intriguing and affordable supporting pieces beneath that, right? Whether it's Connor Garland, mm-hmm. Nils Höglander, Pius Suter. Not to diminish the magnitude of the decisions facing Canucks management, but to some extent, I think the challenge here is to recognize how loyalty can be a trap in a hard cap league, right? There's so many different players who deserve to be rewarded for what they brought to this city and to this franchise over the course of the year. And I don't want to diminish that either, right? Like, Teddy Bluger played top nine hockey, matched his career high, stabilized Vancouver's penalty kill. Ian Cole, I know he struggled in that Oilers series. He had a cut that he was dealing with. He's not going to make that excuse, but I'm going to absolutely put that out there as context because I saw him in the Nashville series. The calm puck moving, the steadiness, the defensive reliability. He brought that all year long until the final six games of the Canucks season. And you'd love to keep him, right? Tyler Myers played what a glow up. Went from, you know, a sort of a whipping boy for the fan base in the early part of the year, put in his best season in Canucks blue. Nikita Zadorov, cult hero. Quotable, monster, right? Just like so sick. There's nothing I want more than to cover 82 games of Nikita Zadorov until I die. Like, are you kidding me? Big guy skates fast, hits hard, drops hilarious commentary after the game. Like, come on. And yet, you know, I don't want to forget Elias Lindholm here either, right? Mm-hmm. Brought it, stepped up big time every time this team moment needed a big moment in the playoffs. And yet, did the Canucks excel this year because of the contributions of those specific players, if those players get paid at fair market value? Or was the success of the team more attributed to the core pieces, like Quinn Hughes leveling up, Besser scoring 40,
yep,
JT Miller setting a career high, Elias Pettersson, especially through the end of January, just doing Elias Pettersson stuff, warping the ice in the Canucks' benefit, Vezina nominee Thatcher Demko, right? And is the key part of what the glue guys that we're talking about, right, is the key part about what they brought, not so much that they're irreplaceable as it is about when you have a high volume of good players at the right ticket, right? So that you're not giving back what your star players are able to generate in terms of outscoring their opponents. That puts you in a position to be a 109-point team, win the division. And so as I'm thinking about this more and more, I'm becoming increasingly convinced that the main challenge for Canucks management, like, it's a ruthlessness test. It yep. really is. It's not about returning this team. Like, this team cannot be returned given the parameters of the hard cap system and given how every single one of those supporting pieces that we enumerated, plus Dakota Joshua, plus Sam Lafferty and his 13 goals, all made not just strong cases, compelling cases, like airtight cases to get significantly paid this summer. Like, all of them deserve a raise and will get a raise on the open market. The task for the Canucks is not to return this team. It's to improve it. It's to improve it materially. And when you think about the space and the resources available to the team, there's not a ton of future assets necessarily, but there is a wash of cap space, 20 million plus. And I'll have a more specific number for you later this week. But 20 million plus, you know, think about what this team did with 11 million last yep. summer. Right? Think about all the talent they were able to add to this lineup. Think about the one thing, like, if you were to trust Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin to do one thing above all else, given their track record in Vancouver, isn't it fill out the depth of the roster with smart value bets? I mean, Kuzmenko in European free agency, Dakota Joshua, Group 6 unrestricted free agent, Neil Zaman was an unsigned draft pick. You know, is Neil Zaman a stud? Like, is he a world beater? No, but he eats innings at zero cost, basically, and zero acquisition cost, too. Great. That's awesome. That's, I think, to me, more than anything, like, we're going to navel gaze and hand-wring about what XYZ pending unrestricted free agent, you know, is going to get, whether they should be brought back, whether they shouldn't be brought back. And it's almost like, I feel like the Canucks almost would be best off instituting like a bid system. Like they were soliciting bids from contractors. It's like need big 4 or 5 defensemen, budget $3.5 million, and just have, you know, your Brendan Dillon types submit there. Oh, I'll do it for two. Great. Like that to me is almost the task at hand, because what the Canucks are losing in terms of their pending free agents are really good players, provided that they're paid at a certain level. And I think that's the key. The contributions, the third line winger who brings grit, Dakota Joshua style, the fourth line center, you can find those guys, and you can find those guys without breaking the bank. This team, more than anything, I think just needs to, and in this fan base too, I think we need to reorient what we're thinking about, and sort of, instead of it being about returning this team, like, don't even try. The point's to get better. And I think that's sort of where you get to, where the task at hand is to identify those players who are willing to take below market rate, because that's all this team can afford, to be part of what the Canucks are building. And those that want to cash in, good luck to them. Congratulations. And thank you for everything. But I don't see a way where, given this team's need to reconstruct their building, blue line, maintain their center depth and significantly upgrade their top six. I don't know that you can commit your cap space to the types of players that the Canucks have expiring. And that's sort of a really fascinating dynamic, especially given this front office's penchant for taking the big swing. It's a big swing summer, baby.
And, you know, your point, there's a lot to unpack there. I think you're bang on, honestly. And Bick and I were kind of having a similar conversation on the show yesterday. And it would be one thing if this team had been, you know, a game away from winning the Stanley Cup, even from going to the Stanley Cup, right? And then you're talking like, okay, we have all these UFAs. We want to run it back. How can we do that? But as Patrick Galvin said, you know, quote, it was only the second round, and that was very disappointing. So even if you were able to, you know, twist yourself into knots and grind everyone down and pull a rabbit out of a hat and return all of these free agents and the UFAs in particular, like, even if you found a way to do it, well, it's still the same team. And it's the same team that Patrick Galvin just last week told us all that he was disappointed with and wasn't good enough. And of course, the goal has to be to get better. So you can only afford to use so many resources and so much of your attention to bring back these guys once you accept that the goal is to get better. And this, this text came in, and your point about, was it the star players or was it the depth players? This text says, no, the key was the depth and Tocchet. Hughes was fantastic the year previous. So was Petey. So was Miller. Demko wasn't, but the team was a lot better with even without him anyways this year. But I think the key point there is, or at least one of the key points, is Tocchet. Right. And it's like, yes, the depth was important, but it's not as if these are the only good depth players in the NHL. Right. And what this team did so well was go out and find the undervalued guys and then also have the right coach who could get the most out of them. Well, guess what? You still have that coach. Right. So you kind of have to lean into, hey, we have Rick Tocchet. So, yeah, maybe we have to turn it over. But look how much turnover we had last year, and Rick Tocchet was able to make them a really complete team by the end of the year. I think you've got to lean on that kind of advantage, in-house advantage that you have, more so than falling in love with the depth players that you brought in last year.
Also, once Tocchet took over from Boudreau last season, so not this past season, but the year prior, like, I watched this team punch above their weight with Christian Wallanen and Cole McWard and Akito Hirose and Ethan Bear, top pair defenseman, you know, in the lineup. And I mean, the depth mattered for sure. The way that this team was able to surgically go out and add size, like graft size and defensive IQ into their blue line to target penalty killers, to find value with Pew Suter. And then also over the course of the season, right? Like, one thing that I was very critical of this team for doing was having too much weight in terms of the cap space allocated to the wings. And then over the course of the season, you know, Tanner Pearson becomes Casey DeSmith plus $1 million in cap space, which becomes Sam Lafferty. Then, you know, Anthony Beauvillier becomes Nikita Zadorov. And then Andre Kuzmenko becomes Elias Lindholm, and all of a sudden this club ends up actually light on the wings in the playoffs, right? When you're as aggressive as this front office is, you can also kind of solve problems midstream, right? Like, you don't have to have, and in fact, you probably won't have a finished product on July 3rd, July 2nd. You know, like, at close of business, July 1, that's not it. Mm-hmm. That's not it by any means. There's time and space to keep tweaking, and given sort of, you know, my view of this, right? Because while I'm talking about the pending free agents and suggesting that the club, you know, needs to be careful about not breaking the bank if they want to be part of this and are willing to take less, great. If not, you know, you go find other guys. I do think a different rubric has to apply to Philip Hronek. So Hronek, we know, is a restricted free agent. He's got arbitration rights. The arbitration rights ensure that, you know, he even on a 1-year deal, he's going to make $6.5 to $7 million, like, period. And obviously, if you want to buy unrestricted free agent years, you're probably going north of that. That seems to have been based on the reporting, although my understanding is that discussions have never necessarily gotten to the point of offers and counteroffers. But, you know, that's where $8 million and those types of numbers that have been thrown out around Philip Hronek, I think somewhat somewhat inaccurately based on my understanding of the character of Tox to this point, but nonetheless, you know, that's where you get to those types of valuations, is once you're thinking long term with Hronek, given his leverage. Look, I don't know that there's any way to reach a settlement with Hronek where the Canucks win, quote unquote, the deal, where the Canucks end up with an efficient contract for Filip Hronek. But guess what? That's the logic of the bet the Canucks placed. Like, we talked about it at the time, that the upside of acquiring Filip Hronek was capped in some ways by the term on his deal, or lack of it, and the fact that he had arbitration rights, so that even if this worked, he was going to be expensive to retain beyond that. Like, we kind of knew that. And guess what? Like, where I do think you can go out and find, you know, really good 4 or 5 defensemen who can bring much of what most of Vancouver's expiring blue liners can bring, you know, as much as I think there's, like, you know, Kevin Stenlund and Travis Boyd and a variety of guys who aren't quite as good as Teddy Bluger, in my opinion, but can do the job, right, for, you know, without you having to go to David Kampf 2.5 times more on a player like Bluger, it can be found, right? To me, you sort of start with who's most irreplaceable. And this is where, like, 48-point top pair right-handed defenseman who has a particular rift with Quinn Hughes, right? A unique level of value given the way that his game complements and sort of builds a bottom line in partnership with your most impactful skater. Like, to me, that's a player, that's a position that I don't think you want to get bogged down too much on the efficiency of it, right? Like, I don't think you want to be putting a Band-Aid at top pair right D at this point. You've paid through the nose to get him. You don't want to sort of chase like a bad bet with more bad bets or whatever, but it wasn't a bad bet. It worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the reason that this is such a tough situation in some ways for the Canucks is that their bet that Filip Hronek was like a necessary piece, was a perfect fit, was right, paid off. And yeah, does that create some discomfort in terms of what his next deal is going to look like? Does it make it really hard for the Canucks to, again, quote unquote, win the negotiation? I think it does, but I also think you can't worry too much. Like, we're talking 1C, 2C, top pair LD, top pair right D. Like, if you're going to swing and swing big and swing on contracts that may not be super efficient, those are the spots to do it in. Those are the spots to do it in, especially when the guy's 26 years old and helped. Like, I don't think Hronek elevated Quinn Hughes necessarily, but I think Quinn Hughes could be a Norris caliber defender without necessarily playing with Filip Hronek. But I do think that the skill set is helpful to allow Quinn Hughes to hit that different level, which he hit this season. I'd be protective of that. So Hronik's sort of the one guy that kind of stands out to me as like the swing, the sort of swing you've got to take, because I don't know. I look through sort of the free agent lists and think about the Canucks' options, and like, top pair right-handed defensemen, we know how hard they are to acquire. Mm-hmm. We know what the Canucks paid for this guy in terms of the acquisition cost. It's not going to be pretty necessarily. It's probably not going to be efficient. But for me, that's sort of the one guy who I sort a little bit differently. That's a top of the lineup piece. That's, if not a core piece, then like a fringe core piece that I think you have to be willing to pay accordingly.
So, look, I understand your point about his value with Quinn Hughes and how important it is to preserve that. I also think the age factor for Filip Hronek is a big deal, because there are lots of interesting right-shot guys on the free agent market. It's just they tend to be more 29-30, right? And he's 26, and that's a big deal when you're talking about locking someone up big term.
And are going to be super expensive, too.
Yeah. My problem,
you know, it's not like you're getting, you're getting savings.
Well, you might, right? Depending on how long you go with Filip Hronek, you might get a couple million. Yeah. Of savings, and again, depending on where you're shopping. My issue with Hronek is, okay, because I think, you know, going back to one of your other pieces of The Athletic, right, stacking the Canucks up against the final four teams is one of the glaring issues in that exercise is the second pair. And so I just start to think about going down the road of building this blue line and finding that really high-end second pair. If you're paying Filip Hronek, let's say $8 million, or even $7.5 million or something, Well, then you still have to go out and get a guy who can drive a Stanley Cup contending second pair. And that's really hard to acquire, right? And so part of me almost thinks, can you go not the full, you know, budget Luke Shen, Noah Juulsen option next to Quinn Hughes, but a kind of mid option, a guy who would be maybe more of a number four, but he's good enough to keep up with Quinn Hughes. You're not paying an arm and a leg, and kind of reserve that Philip Hronek salary slot for ace who's driving your second pair, right? Now, look, Patrick Alvin did say at his end of year press conference that they're maybe interested in using Philip Hronek separately from Quinn Hughes. But I just think if you're paying a second defenseman, you know, 7.5+, and they can only play next to Quinn Hughes on your first pair, like, I take your point about not getting too bogged down in the efficiency, but then it just leaves such a hole on your second pair. And that's one of the key needs this team needs to improve on to get better.
Yeah, I just think, once you start like sort of going down and thinking about it, you know, like the only guys that I sort of look at and think, yeah, that guy could stand in for what Hronek does in terms of the quality of the player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Brandon Montour, who's what, 4 years older?
Sure. And he's going to be super expensive.
And going to cost the same amount.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, And the thing about that exercise, because you're right, the second pair upgrade was definitely part of the sore thumb that stood out. You know, as much as Vancouver's blue line punched above their weight over the course of the Stanley Cup playoffs, like, there's still more needed. You know, the way that I kind of look at it, Jamie, to be totally honest with you, is it's not necessarily that they need to, like, build an upgraded second pair. It's that most of these teams have three top pair caliber defensemen, or like two top pair caliber defenseman in addition to the superstar Quinn Hughes analog that every single one of the final four teams have. Well, if you lose Hronek, all of a sudden you need two.
Yep.
You know, to me, that's just a step back that I don't think you can be willing to take at this point.
You would have to be very confident that you're getting a guy you love in free agency, right? Like, because like I think Brett Pesce would be a great fit. And he's not necessarily an improvement over Philip Hronek, but I think if that's the guy you're signing, just, you know, again, I'm not saying that they're going to be in the market or whatever, but for example, if you bring in Brett Pesce, I think that does a really good job of kind of papering over that hole left by Philip Hronek. But you're right. Then you still need to go out and get the additional guy who's a star. We saw the premium they had to pay to get Philip Hronek in the first place. Now we're having the debate, does he even reach that tier? It's really hard to do. I just think there's a strong case to be made for whatever assets you would get from Philip Hronek in a trade. If you were to go, you know what, this long-term contract doesn't work for us, we're going to move him. Whatever assets you get from Hronek in a trade, plus the ability to shop in the free agent market, being more valuable than signing him up to a long-term contract. I don't know if it's a slam dunk, because there's definitely negatives, there's definitely risks to it, but I think this is it. Like, and this is why he's at the top of your offseason priority list for the Canucks, is because no matter what the resolution is, short-term contract, long-term contract, trade, there's going to be big upsides to it, there's going to be big risks to it, no matter what the resolution is with Philip Hronek.
Yeah, I actually wonder if you might be better off kicking the can down the road, restraining his cap hit for one more year. And then, you know, if you feel the same way that I feel now, that he's an indispensable piece, you know, that then you can make the commitment then. Like, the problem with that is, of course, you don't lock in the upside if this team repeats as being as good as they are, and in which case Philip Hronek's going to be even more expensive from now.
And then you're also in a really tough position going into the trade deadline, right? If you don't have the certainty by then, like, that's really tough.
Well, and every name you're going to find, like Pesce, man, I love the player, but he's going to be 30 in November, and he's a guy who takes a lot of hits and doles out a lot of hits. Like, that's exactly the profile that I'm really scared of, you know, especially if the numbers come in at 7 or anywhere in the same neighborhood as what they will for Philip Hronek, which I'd assume they will, given, you know, the value and the premium placed on right-handed defenders who are as big and as reliable defensively as that gentleman is.
Okay, we will take a break there. Lots of thoughts coming into the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send yours in, 650-650. We've got a couple of guests coming up later in the show. Arda Okal from ESPN and Saad Youssef, who covers the Dallas Stars for The Athletic. So we'll talk conference finals with them, but we will keep getting into the Canucks offseason next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech Studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. So, you know, you were making the point in the first segment, Drance, that the kind of the framing of the Canucks offseason around how can they bring all of these players back is kind of asking the wrong question, right? The question is, how can they get better? Some players, some of the UFAs and the RFAs might be a part of that equation, but they easily might not be, right? Especially because so many of them are in line for significant raises. But again, the flip part of that equation is not, you know, oh man, what happens if we lose Zadorov? What happens if we lose Dakota Joshua? What happens if we lose Elias Lindholm? It's what can we do with the cap space that we have, with the cap flexibility that this franchise has. This is the most meaningful cap space they've had going into a summer in an awful long time, right? And so I think that is probably, I'm imagining that's the way the front office is looking at it, right? Knowing what they were able to do with the much more limited cap space last summer. And you start to look at it in that way. And, you know, you had the piece up at The Athletic. And again, one of the priorities items on the to-do list was land a star forward. Heck, maybe go land two star forwards, right? And the phrase that we throw around a lot on sports radio is big game hunting. I know the guys on the morning show were talking about that, but I think it's just kind of a philosophical shift from, okay, you have X amount of cap space. You don't just have to spend it on your UFAs. There's a whole universe of hockey players out there, some of whom are UFAs, some of whom are under contract, but might be available by trade. And you have to look at all of them. And especially you have to look at the guys who could slot in at the top of your lineup and move the needle for you at forward.
Yeah, I mean, one thing about this exercise is usually I go through it and I'm sort of thinking through the club's options and their positioning and I'm urging caution and taking the long view. And, you know, I increasingly look at this and see Besser has 1 year left, Demko 2, Quinn Hughes 3. JT Miller's 30, is going to be 31 next season. And this is a 109-point team that won their division. I mean, I don't really see this as a... Not that the club should be reckless by any means.
Of course.
But I do see this as one of those opportunities where actually continuing to push chips into the center of the table is probably justified given the structural sort of excellence that this club was able to hit. The way they were able to control play 5-on-5. Their success over the course of the season. Now, are there some concerning indicators about this team potentially regressing next season? There are, but their underlying 5-on-5 form and the way it leveled up over the course of the season is also a data point suggesting sustainability, suggesting that this is a club that can maybe build off of their success, especially, you know, if you buy the way that I do that, you know, Pettersson's second half form does look like it's probably injury related given how dramatic the fall off was. So, you know, putting all that together, I kind of think that one of the problems that you're going to bump into if you're big game hunting, quote unquote, is you don't have your first.
Yep.
You don't have your second. You don't have a huge sort of arsenal of valuable prospects in your system. But you got a couple. Right? Jonathan Lekaramäki, mostly. And then Tom Volander, although, you know, I do get the sense that there was some skepticism, or there's some skepticism about him stemming from a pretty disappointing freshman season at BU. Nonetheless, I think both of those guys would still be hugely marketable. And then you've also got your 2025 first round pick. Now, I think you have to be careful with that, given some of the warning signs about like this club's offensive production being significantly overheated. You know, we know that this was one of the luckiest teams in NHL history from a finishing and goal prevention standpoint through about the first 50, 60 games, like one of the luckiest teams we've ever seen. So, you know, you do have to account for that in adjudicating the risk you're willing to take here. But do you hear my dog going nuts?
Hello. Yep.
Yeah, sorry about that. I guess someone's delivering mail or something. It's one of those two where it's like both me and my wife are on calls. You know what I mean? It's like neither of us can go like calm him down. Anyway, So I think you'd have to put protections in place, but I honestly think that's the sort of weapon that this club needs to be prepared to fire as well this summer, which is just such a departure from where they've been. But I also think is a example of how you have to grapple with the reality as you find it. Like, this club achieved at such a high level over the course of the season that I do think it reorients their priorities, especially because, you know, something I've talked about a lot, I don't see this as like some open-ended decade-long contention window that we're just at the start of. You know, I kind of think this is like the middle of a window that's mostly been spoiled by mismanagement up until this point. And so I do think there should be a little bit of urgency here, and yet there's also a ton of work to do. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, Jamie,
yeah,
because in the wake of the Canucks' first round victory over Nashville, and by the way, the context that I'm presenting this is we're getting some text messages in about, you know, your commentary from segment one about like, hey, it wasn't good enough, right? As Alvin said, and we're getting some pushback like, well, Demko was hurt all playoffs and Besser couldn't play game seven. And imagine, you know, like they were way closer. They only lost by one goal and they averaged 16 shots a game in the final two games of the season with a chance to advance to the conference final. They were outscored 8-3. Like, you do have to grapple, I think, with the fact that this team was agonizingly close and also pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's an important dichotomy, like an oxymoron that you have to grapple with and accept, I think, in sort of evaluating this team. And to just like add a little bit of grist to that, the commentary from Andrew Brunette after the Canucks beat the Predators, where he was like, this is one of the few times in my career where I'm not sure the better team won. Like, that's a loaded commentary from a guy who's been around this league for 30 years, right? And it's not something a coach says lightly. You know what I mean? Like, that's not something that a coach is just like sour grapesing. You know, like, that's like a thoughtful guy who's obviously a heck of a coach, in my opinion, sort of laying out how he saw the series, how he's reflected on the series at length. Because it wasn't even said in the heat of defeat. It was said days later. There's a little bit of disrespect there, right? And then the very next round, you had Chris Knobloch praising Tocchet and sort of slipping. Man, Tocchet did a great job hiding the weaknesses of this roster. And then he catches himself and really getting the most out of his guys, like, goes back to a safer variation. Like, that's pretty wild commentary. You know, like, that is a sign anyway, I think, from smart people within the league, head coaches, that like, hey, we looked at this team and we thought there was more stuff that we could exploit. We had a difficult time doing it. And, you know, granted, that's to the Canucks' credit, but I also think it's worth just sort of spending a second to glance at that signpost and what it means about how the club's positioned, right? I don't think it's enough to say, like, well, if healthy, they could skate with the Oilers. The Oilers outshot them by 50 across that playoff series. Like, the Oilers got the Oilers had their starting goaltender chased from the series and still won. You know, like, the Canucks shot 20% in the first four games of the series, and the Oilers still survived. Like, there are still significant areas of structural improvement that this team needs to hit, I think, if they're going to be considered an inner circle contender next year.
Well, and again, I'm a little surprised this is even controversial, because the person who's expressed the most disappointment with how the team season ended is the general manager, Patrick Alvin, right? Like, he's the one leading this charge and who is kind of starting this conversation in a way. And, you know, to the point about Thatcher Demko specifically, look, could a healthy, informed Thatcher Demko have changed the course of the Edmonton series? Sure. But the Canucks also got easily good enough goaltending to win that series, right? If their offense had been better. So, yes, a healthy Thatcher Demko maybe makes things look a little bit differently, but you also can't look at it and be like, oh, man, their goaltending was such a mess. They couldn't possibly have outplayed that. They easily could have won with the goaltending they got from Artur Shelovs, and that illustrates the point that there are other improvements this team needs to make. And again, like, this is directly from Patrick Alvin, right? He was the one stressing, look, it was only the second round, and we need to find ways to get better. We need to find ways to improve. So it's really just matching the team's own commentary.
You're right. And that's, I think, important, but also, you know, can be like a message or like a show of standards,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a, you know, it's one thing to say we were disappointed, right? It's another thing to behave like you're disappointed and understand the distance still to travel, right? And that's sort of where we I think get into this offseason, where, you know, I do think it's a summer for big swings for the organization. And partly I think those big swings need to graft some additional ceiling onto this team, right? Like, the way that this team succeeded this past year was to sort of raise their floor everywhere, right? Like, you enter the season and it's like, well, we've got a really young backup. Like, no, we don't. Veteran backup in, right? Like, we need a little more speed and size. Sam Lafferty mm-hmm. in, right? Like, you know, Ian Cole, like all these floor bets, like, oh, we need to make sure our third pair is not getting scorched. Okay. We're going to sign a bunch of guys who can do that. You know, like, just like slowly but surely and pretty methodically over the course of both last offseason and this season, they just kind of went about attacking all the risks, kind of risk-proofing the roster so that there was no, you know, like burning tire fire spots where they were going to be in serious trouble. But I still think this is a team that needs ceiling. And I think that's where, you know, the Oilers series was so fascinating, was the Oilers are all ceiling and no floor, right?
Yeah.
And guess what? Like, that at some point you don't, like, the Stanley Cup is won with ceiling. Like, that's what matters. It all matters. Don't get me wrong. But like, fundamentally, the engine that you want to be the most powerful is the one at the top of your lineup. And that's where head to head, right? The top of the Canucks lineup against the top of the Oilers lineup, the Oilers consistently, like, not just came out ahead on the scoreboard or won the series, but like sometimes didn't let the Canucks touch the puck. Right now, maybe a healthy Pettersson changes that equation. You know, maybe a healthy Besser and a variety of other guys who were playing hurt and we'll never know changes that a little bit. But like, I also think Edmonton's stars were hurt. So, you know, it's tough at this time of year to use those sorts of, well, that guy wasn't there, or that guy was dinged up, or excuses, because everyone is equally playing through pain usually at, you know, by the time you get to May. Anyway, I sort of look at this and think that top six forward, like that additional sort of, and honestly, it's like a star winger. It's not just a guy. It's a star winger. You know, it's not Jason Zucker. It might not even be Martin Nakash. Like, it's a star winger that I really think this club needs to hunt. And I don't know that there's any weaponry that they can fire that I'd say is, I mean, obviously, well, you know, as deals come through, we're going to judge it based on the price paid and the quality of the player and on and on. So I'm not like blanket saying any deal they make for a star winger, I will, you know, love. But I do think that that's the sort of, like, if you end up trading, you know, a 2025 first for the right star winger, if you end up trading a Lekkerimäki or a Volander for a star winger this offseason, like, I don't think that's the sort of, as rich as it seems, I don't think that's the sort of move that's like beyond the pale or beyond what this club should be reasonably considering going into this offseason.
Well, and yeah, I mean, so much depends on the actual details of a deal and, totally. And who the player is, obviously. But even
contract,
you know, yeah.
term.
But you go back to the deadline, and the reporting around the deadline wasn't so much that like Lekkerimäki and Vilander are completely off the table. It was more not for a rental, right? Like, we would absolutely not do them for a rental, but if it was a player that was a long-term fit, well, then all of a sudden it becomes more of a conversation, and I think that's still probably the place they should be in, right? Like, if it's very different trading one of those guys for, you know, 31-year-old pending UFA at the deadline versus trading it for, you know, 26-year-old star winger in the summer that is either signed already to a bunch of term or that you think you can sign long term at a good cap hit, right? So I think that's a crucial factor in this, is if you can find a guy not just for next year but somebody who fits as a star for the next 3, 4, 5 years beyond that, that completely changes the dynamic of what type of futures you should be willing to give up. Now Keith texted in, so who's the big names in the big name hunting? Well, you know, you mentioned, does Marty Natchez even fit the bill? I tend to think he does, right? Like, just as someone with the upside. Now, is he an established star? No, fair enough. But I still think that would be a very interesting acquisition. Beyond that, though, I mean, I'm sure we'll have a chance to really dig into all the potential trade targets and all of that. But is there a name that kind of jumps top of mind to you?
Ehlers.
Yeah.
Nikolaj Ehlers is the one that I think has, you know, I really think he's been underutilized in Winnipeg pretty consistently over the course of his career. I think he's, you know, one of those like superstar players that just doesn't get superstar player treatment in terms of power play ice time, in terms of actual 5-on-5 ice time, in terms of the quality of the line mates that he plays with. Like, to me, that's the sort of, because, you know, I do think you're trying to find almost like the JT Miller effect, right? Where you acquire a guy who's more talented than his deployment suggests, and then in a bigger role, right, he can do stuff that was never imagined of him in his previous stops, right? Like, no one in Tampa Bay thought this guy can run, you know, an elite power play, and this guy can be a 100-point center, you know, like he completely changed sort of the tenor or the trajectory of his career with all the deployment, you know, he could shake a stick at in Vancouver. For me, Ehlers is like the guy who most, you know, if you talk about Nekash, I like the speed and I love the puck skills and I'm a fan of the player. But I do think there's some hockey sense limitations that give me some pause on the idea of him like significantly leveling up, as opposed to just being like a really good, you know, like first or second line fringe guy. You know, like, he's a bona fide first line player, but is he a high end first line player? Like, is he someone who can, you know, elevate Pettersson or, you know, play 20 minutes a game or sort of scratch some upside that, you know, in that JT Miller type fashion? For me, Ehlers is a better bet for that on an expiring contract, of course, and some rumors and reporting suggesting that at the very least, the Winnipeg Jets might gauge that market over the course of the summer. You know, likewise, there's obviously some rumors and innuendo about Mitch Marner in Toronto. To me, though, that's, you know, that's the highest upside guy, but there's obviously significant concerns there. I'm still team Marner for what it's worth. But I think if you have skepticism about his ability to raise his game when it counts, that's not even something I'd push back on. Like, that's well-founded at this point, given the size of the sample. So, you know, certainly that would be a big, big roll of the dice. But, you know, those are sort of three names among the non-free agents that stand out to me. And then once you look at the free agents, you know,
it's really Guentzel.
I mean, it's Guentzel, and, like, I love me some Jonathan Marchessault.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think those are kind of the only two guys that fit the bill.
Yeah, and even Marchessault, I mean, I just saw that he said he hasn't had any contract talks with them yet. But, I mean, Marchessault is 33. He'll turn 34 in December. So if you're talking about not even a long-term fit, but like a medium-term fit, I mean, that's a lot of risk. Look, Conn Smythe winner, all of that, great player, don't get me wrong, but that's a lot of risk.
He's going to play
this
forever,
season.
Man. I'm telling you right now, that guy's going to play forever. That guy's like a hockey cockroach. Unkillable.
Oh, man. Hey, coming off a 40-goal season with the Vegas Golden Knights. So he's going to be very much
in demand. And going to have another one, too.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
No, I'm serious. Like, there's no guy who's had a bigger outlier path to his career to this point than that, than Marchessault. You know, he's completely built like a bumper car. I don't know. That to me would be the old guy that I'd gamble on being a real outlier, given that nothing in his career has made sense to this point anyway.
Yeah, and then after that in the UFAs, you get down to more of the, not like guys who could be a really good part of your top six potentially, like a Tyler Toffoli or something, but that wouldn't necessarily fall in the, you know, the big game hunting rubric, right? Which again, they need to go big game hunting, and then they probably, even if they land a star winger, you need to go out and add another top six guy on top of that, right? So that's not to write off, you know, the Tyler Toffoli, those types of players. It's just that would be kind of step two in the remake the top six and boost the offense plan. Now, Brendan and Nanaimo texts in, I don't understand how the Canucks can re-sign Hronek and go big game hunting for a top six forward. How do they fit the rest of the roster under the cap in that scenario? Look, they have a lot of cap space. Now, would they have to make some very difficult decisions in that universe? Yeah, probably. And they'd have to really be aggressive trying to find those affordable bottom six, lower half of the lineup players. But there is a path to, one, retaining Hronek, two, going out and adding some more star talent and still being able to credibly fill out the rest of this roster.
Absolutely there is. I mean, you know, this is a team that should have, and again, I don't want to give my number because I really need to actually model it, and it's a rigorous process for me, but it's well over 20, and I suspect once I actually fill it in, it's going to be something like 24, 25 million to play with. So that back of the envelope. And then, you know, in the event that the right deal came along, does that cause you to consider a variety of different options with, say, an Ilya Mikheyev, right? Which could then carve out even more space, more flexibility. And by the way, we've seen how dexterous this management group is willing to be in solving problems. Like, we want this, we have too much here, we will send money out to make this happen. You know, I often bring up the Sutter for Bonino example, right? Which was something that Rutherford and company did, foisting, you know, winning a trade against the Vancouver Canucks, regrettably. But the essentially the logic was Brandon Sutter was expiring in Pittsburgh. They knew that they couldn't afford his extension, and they turned his $3.5 million cap hit on the last year of his deal into two centermen in Nick Bonino from Vancouver at 1.2 for 2 years. Bonino, of course, the third line center for the Penguins in their back-to-back cup winning seasons. And then also signed Eric Fehr, who gave them, you know, an additional versatile fourth line guy with some size and offensive punch, and improved them overall, even if at the time everyone saw it as like a downgrade at third line center. It really wasn't, given what Bonino was able to do defensively, but offensively for them, and the chemistry he found with Hagelin and Phil Kessel. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that maybe this club's going to have to consider too, as they sort of go down this path and consider their options. But, you know, even things like, you could try and do something like 4 years at 1.5 for Artur Seelofs, as an example, as your backup, right? You could consider bringing in a veteran backup, right? Or in a world where you have the chance to land the right star forward, right, you can likewise grind Artur Seelofs, who doesn't have arbitration rights, down to signing a veteran minimum deal that's at least a one-way contract, which is more than he's entitled to on his qualifying offer. And you leg through one season like that to sort of maximize your space elsewhere. And, you know, there's a whole host of moves in a similar vein that the Canucks can consider here. You know, Filip Hronek on a one-year settlement as opposed to a multi-year deal, you know, that can cut $1.5 million off if you think you're close enough to really push like more chips into the center of the table for the benefit of this season. There's a variety of things that can be done, I think, to create the space. And again, the club has a ton of it. I mean, even if you're talking about adding, a $6 or $7 million forward and signing Hronek at $7.5 million, you're still probably looking at the same amount of cap space that the club had last offseason when they fundamentally redesigned this team. You know, like, I think it's important to sort of go through that exercise and consider it, or consider this club's options from that perspective. Like, you literally probably have space to sign two big pieces and then also, you know, attack the bottom end or the depth of the roster or the blue line or the bottom six in sort of a budget conscious way, similar to what the club did last summer. That's a ton of flexibility. And again, is sort of why I think we need to reframe the can they keep Zadorov, can they keep Joshua, can they keep Lindholm discussion less fearfully, less negatively. Like, it's not, and I don't mean negative from the perspective that people call me negative. I mean negative from the perspective of like reactive,
yeah.
Right? This is an opportunity. You know, like the club's flexibility, the fact that they have all these expiring guys, you know, would it have been great to have a little more of the upside that this club realized this season locked up? For sure. But, you know, I don't think you can look at it as something that, oh, the club's going to lose all these pieces. It's like the club has the opportunity to begin to fill in, you know, or flesh out or sort of find a new, better expression of what this team can be in addressing their needs, as opposed to being sort of stuck in a way with a team that was exceptionally successful this past season, and yet also I think not quite at the level of winning a Stanley Cup.
All right, we will take a quick break here. Arda Okal from ESPN's NHL coverage joins us next on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.